Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Welcome back. Áine Kerr here, sitting in for Brendan. Neil Jordan, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for joining us. Now, Neil, listeners will know you've written many books. I think this is your 11th, but it's your first memoir, and I've enjoyed reading it. It's called Amnesiac, and while it's not a standard memoir, it brings through all of your reflections and chronology of your life, but there's poetry in it, there's photos, there's paintings, there's short stories, there's lots of Hollywood stars like Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt, but it's full of imagination and dreaming throughout as you take us from 1950s Catholic Ireland to 1970s London, 1990s Los Angeles. But I want to start with that brain, that imagination, and take us back to your childhood, the early years, because your mum and dad feature a lot in this book, and you know, your dad's ghost stories, your mum bringing you to the cinema. Did that really fuel this unique imagination that you have?
I don't know that I've got a unique imagination. I don't know that I have any kind of imagination. But it was, you know, Ireland in the 50s was a very constrained kind of place, you know. It was like, and it was a very odd place. It was like you'd been dropped from some spaceship into this weird little suburban thing, you know. I mean, I was born in Sligo and I grew up in Dollymount, really, Clontarf, you know, and you think, is the world really like this, you know? And so maybe your imagination just tries to fill in the gaps.
And fueled, though, by your dad, he was unafraid of telling you some pretty scary stories. Your mom, in the book, you tell that story of her taking you to the cinema. I think you were only five
or six.
Yeah,
my mother took me to
Killer Ants.
Yeah, she took me to see a movie called Them. Have you ever seen it?
No, I'm terrified of anything.
It's not terrifying. It terrified me as a kid. It's about killer ants. And we were... you know, I don't think we'd moved to Clontarf by then, but I knew these beaches, you know, and it was about these monstrous ants crawling over dunes, assaulting LA. I don't know why she took it to me to it, but it terrified the life out of me. But you know, you're a kid, you believe everything you see is real, don't you? And if somebody tells you a story, if somebody tells you, oh yeah, I saw a headless horseman last night, you believe it. If somebody tells you that God exists, you believe it, you know. So, I mean, you've no defences against, and you've no differentiation between what's real and what's not, you know.
And were you banking those stories, those experiences, those tales from your dad?
Not really. It was just really odd, really. He had a particular interest. I mean, he was a mathematician, really, and he ended up being a kigwra, you know, teaching teachers in St. Pat's and Drumcondra. But he was... you know, for somebody so logical, it's weird to believe in this afterlife business. You know, and I'm not talking about God and Holy Mary and the saints and all that. I mean, believe in real things like poltergeists, you know. When my sister Derville was around 12, he swore that the entire house was inhabited by a poltergeist or whatever that is, you know. You know, kind of an unseen presence that rattles, you know, kind of cupboards and all that. And apparently it's because she was going through pubescence at the time. But he was convinced of that, you know.
And did you get anything of his mathematical brain?
None whatsoever. No. I was very bad at maths, actually. I was really terrible at it, you know. I was good at geometry for some reason because I could see the problems, you know, and I could see the shapes. But I was terrible at mathematics. I didn't understand it at all. But...
And you moved from Sligo to Dublin, I think Stillorgan at first, then out to Clontarf, started going to school, and your dad was well known by all the teachers.
Well, yeah. I mean, every teacher in Ireland would know my father, you know, every male teacher, let me put it that way, the female ones perhaps not. But and they all say, oh, I knew your father, he's a great man. I said, okay, fine, yeah. But it was weird. I went to Belgrove, you know, and at a certain stage, I realised that the teachers... were afraid of my father, yeah? Because one guy, because most teachers at the time were from the country, you know? But there was this one, he was a city guy and he had long fingernails, I remember, and he whacked me across the cheek one day and he drew blood, yeah? But he was so nervous about the fact, he kept dabbing it and saying, are you all right, are you all right? And I realised, okay, my father is his inspector, that's why he's so worried, not because he whacked the face off me, but... because there was evidence of the fact, you know, that kind of thing.
And one of your teachers was John McGarren.
Yeah, John McGarren, yeah.
Did your father have dealings with him?
Oh, my father, he was his kigger, I suppose, you know. You know, I'm sure they butted heads. But yeah, John taught us for about a year and a half or 2 years, and then he just vanished. He did a vanishing act.
Where did he vanish to? What? Were you conscious where he went at
the
time?
No, we hadn't got a clue. He just went. Nobody explained where he went. Oh, there's a teacher there. Suddenly he's gone. Okay, why? We don't know. Maybe he's gone to heaven. Maybe he's gone to purgatory. Maybe he's gone to hell. In fact, I think he went to Sweden. He married a Swedish, or he married a Scandinavian divorcee of some kind, you know. And that was why he, that was why the good burghers of Clontarf came en masse and demanded that he be expelled, or that he be, that he not teach their children anymore. You know?
What kind of a teacher was he, John McGarhy?
John, he was a bit. He was a bit like I would have been as a teacher, a bit distracted, you know, not entirely interested in the 30 kids in front of him, you know. I remember he used to wear one of these country tweed suits, you know, and he used to always push the window open. That's all I remember about
him.
Yeah, really.
There was his own imagination and being a
well, I'm sure he was writing at the time. Teaching was a good job, you know. It was a handy job, wasn't it? It was the only job probably available to somebody either teaching or the bank, you know.
And a little bit of serendipity, you were hanging out with Dermot Morgan in those years.
No,
as well.
No, no, that's a weird one. Yeah, when we lived in some place in around Black Rock or somewhere, some little street with tiny little bungalow houses, and apparently I used to play with this guy. We used to cycle our tricycles around together. I met him years later and said, "That's you, is it, Father Ted? It was you." He says, "Yes, it was me. How are you?"
Well, when you put the link, together, years and years on.
Yeah, yeah.
Those teenage years, which you get into in the book, it strikes me you had so much freedom as a teenager, and you just immersed yourself in music. There was day clubs, there was nightclubs. Bring us back to
well,
those years.
My parents must have just allowed me to do everything, anything really. I mean, I do remember being. In England in 1966, when Britain beat Germany in the World Cup. And I remember I remember being in this pub with all these navvies, Irish guys, and they were all cheering for Germany, you know. And I was 16. I was saying, what on earth was I doing in London at the time? How did they let me go there, you know? I mean, I don't know. They just let me do whatever I wanted to do, I suppose, because they couldn't work out what was going on with me, probably, you know.
You got a lot of autonomy, a lot of independence.
Maybe, you know, but I mean, it was a fun city then. You know, if you ignored the kind of all-pervasive hand of the church and all that. But I mean, I managed to have a lot of fun. I remember working out from the day I left school on a Friday to the day I went back on a Monday. I could be in a club every hour of Saturday, Sunday. Friday night, you know. But, one had a lot of fun, let's put it that way.
So you weren't studying, you weren't doing the homework over the weekend. You were out having the experience, living the life.
I've no idea. I don't. That's just what I remember, you know. But I studied. Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Because those years brought you to UCD and Dramsoc.
Well,
Sheridan.
I mean, I did my Leaving Cert and, you know, I went to UCD because you weren't allowed to go to Trinity because, you know, you weren't a Protestant. It's a strange thing. Yeah, I went to UCD. I studied, you know. I did a bit of, you know, myself and Jim took over the Drama Society there and kind of tore it to bits, really. And, you know, had quite a lot of... I didn't enjoy studying literature at all, I have to say, you know. Perhaps because I loved it too much, you know. So the kind of academic study of this thing that's so emotional for you seemed to me kind of sacrilegious a bit, really.
Because it's teaching you the process and the craft as opposed to just...
It also seemed it was being taught by people who had very little love for the entire endeavour, you know. But now maybe I'm being a bit unkind, but that's my memory of it. I didn't like an experience that was so emotional being dissected as if it was a piece of philosophical kind of exegesis or something like that.
And is that why you found yourself then acting in a play?
No, I should never. I did act in one. We put on a version of Oedipus Rex with a rock and roll band, and we put it on a Newman House. It lasted for about 3 hours, and centre of it was a kind of a performance that I did. I was playing Tiresias, some prophet. I don't remember exactly what I used to do, but I used to pretend to go into a trance, and people thought it was kind of interesting. But, you know, I didn't want to. I, I never acted again. I didn't want to.
So that was your first and last time. Was Jim Sheridan directing?
Yes,
at that
he
time?
Directed that. Jim and his brother Peter. Yeah. It was a cool experience. It was It was the big acid time. You know, people were taking LSD and smoking dope, and they all used to go to the Grafton Cinema to watch 2001, and they'd have taken, you know, a tab of acid. And when they'd just be winding down, they'd come in to see our show. Yeah.
They'd have to sit through 3 hours.
Yeah, they enjoyed it, though. They enjoyed it. They did, yeah.
And you and Jim Sheridan, as you say, met in UCD. What was the friendship like over the years? Because you partnered on
well,
lots
it's
of
not,
different
it, it, it's, you know, I mean, Jim was a very intriguing guy. You know, he was from Seville Place and Sheriff Street. He was from a working class background. I think he put himself through college through betting on horses, you know. And very bright. And, you know, I wouldn't say it wasn't the closest friendship that I've had in the world, you know what I mean? But we shared quite a few experiences, you know, and we were obviously, we at the time when we were working, when he had a company called Slot Players. We set up another company called the Children's Tea Company, where we used to do street theatre and all that sort of stuff. And we got involved in the earliest kind of version of the project theatre, and you know, we dreamed of movies, but we didn't see any way of making them, you know, because it seemed movies were made by Italians or glamorous French people or Americans with big cigars. You know, it didn't seem anything that Irish people would ever do, you know. And it's odd that we both ended up actually being able to make them, which is weird, yeah, and wonderful, actually.
And part of your way of trying to make it in terms of writing and going on to direct was moving to London and trying there. But that was very hard at first. Like the book, the memoir, it's grim at times. You're sleeping rough. And
yeah, well, you know, you can fall between the cracks, you know what I mean? And it happens very easily. And that's why I think, I mean, I was kind of just sleeping on the street for a while, basically. But it was, yeah, a few weird experiences, yeah. And there were no mobile phones at the time, you know. The first thing that happens is you get filthy, yeah. And the second thing that happens is you get a sense of shame, you know, because you feel people stop looking at you, even seeing you as something that just walked past you. You know, so you get into this state of mind, and then you meet all these weird and wonderful people all drinking cider by nighttime fires in a park and stuff like that. And then it gets a bit dangerous. And then you say, look, I've got to get out of this or I'm stuck in this forever. And you manage to get out, you know.
How did you cobble money together just to exist day to day, even when sleeping rough?
Oh, I have no idea. I think I got a job eventually, some kind of job, you know.
And you describe it as being dangerous and you
No, nothing. I was sold into sex slavery. Yeah, that was fun.
What happened there? So we're trying to help you out.
No, I'm standing in the, that's a kind of a comedic way of describing it. I'm standing at Tottenham Court Road Station, I think it is. And a Scottish couple come up and say, hey, they say, I can't do the accent. They say, you look a bit lost, Head. Do you need a place to sleep for the night? Do you need a crash pad? I said, oh, yeah, I'd love that. You know, so we go on the tube and we go, you know, past the recognisable kind of London kind of suburbs into, I don't know where, tiny little suburban streets. We get off the tube, we walk into this house. There's a guy there and I turn around, they're gone. I go, oh, my God, I've been delivered like a pizza, you know. It was a strange experience, but it was fine, you know.
And what did happen that in that crash pad?
There was no crash pad. Yeah. It was just a rather bulky, large Levantine man who expected a sexual event, I suppose, which didn't happen, you know. But it was odd. I just wondered, did these people do that as a matter of course? You know, I just wondered what they were paid, what was the exchange, you know. It was kind of weird. You know, I mean, I spoke to the guy, look, there's a big misunderstanding here. You know, I'm going to go soon. He said, fine, go. But it was weird. Kind of made me hate hippies, you know. But
it was potentially vulnerable, very dangerous situation to be in, but to get yourself out of, ultimately.
Yeah, vulnerable. But, you know, I mean, one emerges from that. I'm sure these things happen to a lot of people, don't they, you know. But when I made that movie, one of the reasons I made that movie, Breakfast on Pluto, which was based on the Pat McCabe novel, and I didn't really want to repeat the same kind of sense of a character that I'd used in The Crying Game. But one of the reasons I wanted to make it as a film was because it reminded me of those experiences, you know, the experience of the character Kitten in London and stuff like that. But, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah, a real life experience went on to inspire something in your own writing. You had an opportunity to go to National Film School in England. But
yeah.
Money was a barrier at
no,
the
it's
time.
Not, no, it's not that. It's when I came out of college, we were doing some work with Jim. We'd written some plays and stuff like that, and I submitted. I applied for a place in the National Film School in England, and I got a place. Yeah, but if you were English or from the north of Ireland, you would have gotten grant aid. You know, I, being not from that environment, couldn't get it, and I couldn't afford to go there, so I didn't go. You know.
And when you reflect back, does that feel like had you had that opportunity, you might have had your breakthrough sooner?
No, I'm not sure actually, because when I began to make movies and I moved to London and I met a lot of people who had been in the National Film School, and they often got stuck there for years, you know, doing these graduate films, doing these kind of, and I'm kind of lucky I didn't go to it in a way, you know, because. You could have just gotten stuck in this eternal kind of master thesis student film world kind of thing, you know.
And studying back to your earlier point when you were studying literature.
Well, I mean, I basically don't think there's anything to learn about anything. You know, if you want to do creative things, you should do them. You know, I don't think anybody can teach you.
And that's what you did. You were scripting, you were constantly tweaking, ideating. You got your breakthrough through John Berman in Ardmore.
Yeah, John read some of my stuff, and John invited me out to Ardmore, and he asked me to write a script with him, which I did, which he never managed to make. And then he was working on Excalibur, and he asked me to go through the last version of the script with him, which I did. And then he wanted me around on the set. So I said, well, why don't I make a documentary on you making this huge movie, which... He said, okay, and he shaved off a little bit of the budget for me to do that. So that, to me, was like almost like a film school. You know, I had a wonderful cameraman, Seamus Deasy, and his brother Brendan, and we had a 16mm camera, and we just followed John around and shot our own version of Excalibur, you know, with, you know, John wrestling with his version of Excalibur. It was the coolest thing, actually. It was really kind of interesting, and it was a great way to learn about making movies, really.
And you start to strike up lots of friendships. One was with Stanley Kubrick, a famous director. He features a lot in the book. Tell me about how that friendship started off and what it looked like over the years.
Well, I had made a movie called Angel, and I was living out in Bray, and my daughter was living with me, Sarah and Anna. And I came back one night and Sarah said, oh, a guy called Stanley Cooper called you. I said, what? And she said, yeah, he sounded English or American. I said, okay. And then the next day, he said, oh, the same guy, Stanley Cooper, called you again. He left a number. So I called it up, the number, and it was Stanley Kubrick, you know. And I went, oh, okay, Stanley, how are you? And we had a great series of conversations. And then he said, if you ever come to London, let's have dinner. I went to London. I met him. But I think Stanley had relationships with a lot of directors because he didn't fly. He had removed himself from Hollywood, America. And he kind of made the system work for himself in his house. He had an estate in St. Albans, you know. And I think he had relationships with an enormous amount of directors through the telephone, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I really welcomed the friendship and the conversation. He was a fascinating man. He hired my designer, Anton Furst. I was making a movie called The Company of Wolves. And Stanley hired him to make Full Metal Jacket and almost drove poor Anton insane. But Anton did a wonderful job on that. And, you know, so we got to know each other. And through the years, we'd talk and I'd be making a movie. He'd say, what are you doing? And I'd say, oh, well, I'm doing this and that. And he'd say, okay. And we'd chat.
And it feels like the stories in the memoir, he was like a father you wanted to or maybe had to please on occasion.
Well, I don't understand really. It's, yeah. But I think he performed the same function for a lot of filmmakers, you know, Brian De Palma, John Borman, I know, they used to talk constantly, Steven Spielberg, David Mamet, you know, I mean, as I went on making films, I realised Stanley had these relationships with quite a few people, you know.
And as you went on making movies, Company of Wolves, Mona Lisa, End of the Affair, you back then started to become conscious of the so-called blockbuster. Talk to me about what you think that meant for the industry that you loved and love.
The blockbuster. Well, I mean, it was the age of the blockbuster, wasn't it? You know, I mean, when was Jaws, when did Jaws hit the cinemas? When did Star Wars? Around 1980, the 80s, early 80s, late 70s, you know. And, you know, when I went to Hollywood, it was kind of, do you remember that Woody Allen movie, Midnight in Paris?
Yeah.
You got the characters hanging around Paris to say, oh, it's lovely, but wouldn't it have been great to be here in the 50s, you know? And then you have a scene in the 50s and people are saying, oh, it's great, gorgeous, but wouldn't it have been great to hear, to have been here in La Belle Epoque? And then you go back to, and they're constantly talking about a great period that has escaped them somehow. That's the feeling you get in Hollywood, or I got anyway, you know. You know, it's it was going through one of its most successful periods, I think, in the 80s, 90s, you know. And but they kept saying, oh, the whole place has been destroyed by the blockbuster, you know, by the fact the four quadrant movie. And, you know, it's but it was a good time to be there if you wanted to experience Hollywood in all its naked kind of ambition and glory and savagery, you know what I mean? I mean, now it's a totally kind of depleted place. It's really, streaming has just kind of torn it to bits, really.
And you've lived in Hollywood, in Los Angeles, and the book talks about, I think you refer to it as the muddle, because there's rules associated. Just explain
well,
to
that's
us.
Well, there's two things in this book that I put into the book that were published before. One is a kind of a series of rhyming couplets, which you could perhaps call a poem. That was published in a movie magazine years ago. And the other is that article. And it's, well, I mean, first of all, the first thing about LA is you can't get anywhere without driving, okay? So you don't walk. You can't get a subway. There are no buses. There are buses, but if you get them, you'll be waiting a long time. So you need a car. That's the first thing. Second thing is, even if you go into a breakfast joint, there's a guy there, you know, in a red outfit or something, he parks your car for you. So you got to give him a ticket. There's all these strange little rules, you know what I mean? And if you get them wrong, you can end up in a great mess, a great muddle, you know? And I suppose one of the greatest of them is these enormous kind of car parks. I mean, that article was actually written about a preview in a cinema, which was in a, I don't know where, Silver Lake or somewhere like that. And so you drive to these malls, you know, you park your car, you know, there's probably 20 levels and you drive and you park it, you go down to the preview, then you go back, you forget where you've parked your car. And you say to the people, I don't remember where I parked my car. They go, you idiot, who does that? You know, and you've got to wander this bloody car park. And they can be quite dangerous places, looking for the level at which you parked your car, you know. It's like, so that's what I mean by the muddle, I suppose.
Yeah, different rules, different ways of working and living in Hollywood. And in the book, you talk about casting Tom Cruise for Interview with the Vampire. You talk about Brad Pitt, but you apologise to Brad Pitt in the book. Why?
Well, Brad had a hard time in that film. He really did. And he told me that he was having a hard time. And I think because he was playing such a passive role, really, you know, and I think he just realized the full passivity of the role as we were making the film. You know, I mean, anyone who's seen the movie knows there is Louis and there is Lestat, and the entire story of the film is Lestat punishing Louis and teasing him and kind of hounding him through the centuries, really, you know. So, you know, there's one kind of active participant and there's one passive participant, and that was, Brad was playing the passive participant. I think it just got him down, basically.
Because you were filming at night as well, wasn't it?
Like, yeah, we had to do the whole thing at night. Not only did we have to do the whole thing at night, we had to do the whole thing hidden, because it was such a cause célèbre, let's put it that way, you know, and the casting of Tom Cruise made every journalist in America wanted to get a picture of him. So even when we shot in streets in New Orleans or San Francisco, we had to kind of shroud the whole streets off so no paparazzi could get a picture and stuff like that. So it became kind of a paranoid experience. So, I mean, I loved it because we were stuck together as in a little bunch making this huge, extravagant story. But, you know, I'd say as an actor, it was quite wearing. And I invented this technique for because I just had my my second Brenda just had her first child, Daniel, yeah, and I saw his face as a kid, and the veins used to show on his forehead and his face, you know, because the skin probably is so thin. I said, that's what these vampires should look like. So we did various tests. We had to hang the actors upside down so the veins would bulge, you know, and then a makeup artist would trace them, yeah, with a tiny blue makeup pencil. So all of these actors who were playing vampires, they had to spend about a half an hour upside down before they even got to the set, really. So it was quite a wearing experience, yeah.
I can only imagine. And you've had the huge successes, The Crying Game, of course, the Michael Collins movie, Butcher Boy. You've done the memoir now. You've written the books. What's next for Neil Jordan?
Me? Oh, my God, I've no idea. I'd like to keep going, you know. I'd like to make a movie. I'm trying to make a movie on the last novel I published, which is called The Well of St. Nobody. I'm trying to get the budget together for that. We'll see, do I get to make it in September? I hope to. You know, I'd love to be doing a really kind of craggy, complicated, intelligent TV series if I can find one. You know, writing these large-scale TV things is a rather wonderful experience. You know, I did it once with the Borgias. It was great. And, you know, I'm going to write another novel, you know, but I doubt if I'll write another memoir.
And most immediately, you're out to Dalkey Book Festival tomorrow.
Tomorrow, yeah, tomorrow.
And it's sold out, people will see you out and about. Well, congratulations on the memoir, Amnesiac, which is published by Head of Zeus. As I mentioned there, Neil Jordan will be in conversation with Stephen Rea at the Dalkey Book Festival tomorrow at 7 p.m. He's also going to be appearing at the Seamus Heaney Home Place in Ballaghy, County Derry, on Thursday, June 20th. Neil Jordan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.